Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 26th of January. All things political this hour, Ken Rudin, the man who flatly predicted we'll find out when that Barack Obama would become the 44th president of the United States, will be joining us momentarily. We have a lot to talk about with him the first week in office and the part of President Barack Obama. The number of jobs that keep getting cut, that NPR News at the top of the hour, that Sprint's cutting 8,000 jobs. And of course, that will bring us to whether or not there can be a broad stimulus package, what form it will take, what kind of opposition there will be from Republicans this week. Caroline Kennedy pulling the plug on her bid to be in the U.S. Senate. We will talk about that, and Blagojevich, and just all kinds of things with Ken Rudin joining us at the top of the hour. Mark Silva will be joining us the second half hour of this hour, national correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, Washington Bureau. Phone calls always welcome. The number is 800-486-8655. Ken is the political editor for National Public Radio. He directs campaign coverage for the network. He has been covering every congressional race in the nation since 1984. He has a huge campaign button collection, and he has been a political junkie for many decades. We're happy to have him with us, and welcome phone calls, as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655. Ken Rudin, good morning.
Good morning. I didn't realize I was that old.
Well, you're not that old.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you'll live a long time because there will be much to cover, right? You said in one of your blogs recently that you flatly predicted that Barack Obama would be the 44th president. When did you predict that?
Well, it was the morning of January 20th. I got up and I see a lot of people excited. And I said, something is going on today. And I saw, you know, I took the Metro in at 5:30 in the morning because it was just a zoo in Washington. And thousands of people, thousands and thousands just walking, people walking to the Capitol. I knew something was up, and it was that day that I realized that Obama was going to be president.
Yeah, it was that day. Yeah. It was such a scene, wasn't it? What was it like to be there? All those people, I couldn't believe it.
Well, it was, I'm trying to think of, I mean, it wasn't the greatest speech I ever heard him give.
Right.
It wasn't, but it was something about, I guess, perhaps a combination of the past 8 years, the combination of what he represents and who he is. I know a lot of people have accused the media of drinking the Kool-Aid on Obama. And look, you know, if he's going to falter, we'll be on top of it. And if he's going to make mistakes, we're going to, you know, hold him accountable. But I guess at least for this one brief shining moment, or at least on January 20th and then the early part of our honeymoon, people are willing to, you know, I mean, not willing, but they're all hoping for him and praying for him that things will work out. But, you know, politics being politics, and of course, if there were no politics, I'd be out of a job. You know, things will change. But for right now, we're all hoping for the best.
Yeah. It was an austere speech. I thought he crafted a good speech considering the times. It was very different than what he's given before. And you have to think purposely so, don't you, Ken?
Well, look, I do. I think, you know, I mean, it's probably what has vaulted him to the top and vaulted him beyond, past Hillary Clinton in the primaries and John McCain in the general election. A lot of it was policy, but a lot of it was his rhetoric and his oratory and the way he speaks. And people really like that. But again, I think there's a sense that he just, you know, wanted to start the week, you know, start his presidency immediately getting to work. And I think for all the flourishes we've heard over the last 2 years of the campaign, it was time to, you know, as I said, roll up your sleeves and get to work. So there was no question about what's on his plate and what's on everybody's plate. And as for all the bad news about the economy, the sense is that we have not seen the worst of it. And I think Obama wanted to make sure everybody knew that.
And what do you think of his work of the first week?
Well, I mean, you know, he certainly, there's no question that, I mean, we knew during the campaign that he wanted to represent something different than for what his predecessor did. And we saw that, of course, with proclamations on lobbying, on ethics. You know, he also, it's interesting, his first day, he made important phone calls to the head of the, you know, the Palestinians and the president of Israel and the prime minister of, you know, the head of Egypt and Jordan. There were some kind of fumbles with his cabinet that didn't work out as exactly as he liked, but ultimately, I mean, while there was a holdup with Eric Holder for Attorney General and Tim Geithner for Treasury, ultimately they will be on board. But I mean, there's some, you know, some embarrassments there and some things he probably wished didn't happen. But for the most part, you know, you get a sense that he, look, I just remember comparing it to the last Democrat, Bill Clinton, in 1993, who had so many problems, the nanny problems with Zoe Baird, his choice for attorney general, controversy over gays in the military. There was a lot of controversy and discord. Bill Clinton's initial days, you haven't had that with Barack Obama.
What's your sense, Ken? Every day, today included, you start the week in sprints laying off 5,000 people. Tell me what you think he's going to be able to get through Congress and when concerning a stimulus package and how much opposition there is to his plan on the part of Republicans.
Well, ultimately, I think that it's very possible that his biggest problem may be with his fellow Democrats and the Republicans. Mm. The Republicans don't have much of a say. Certainly, look, you could have a minority. You could be down by one seat in the House and you have no power. That's how much power the majority party has in the House. But, you know, the Republicans lost another 20-some-odd seats this year when they lost 30 2 years ago. So that's 50 fewer Republicans than they had, you know, 3 years ago. And, of course, with only 41 Senate Republicans in the Senate, you know, it's hard to say what Republicans could do. They could, I guess, obstruct if they need to, if they have to. But ultimately, I think with this stimulus package, with the economic problems, it may be a battle between Obama and his kind of centrist kind of administration and the more liberal wing of the Democratic Party, who probably wants more spending, kind of programs that would create jobs quicker. We expect that the stimulus package will be on the president's desk around Valentine's Day, the 14th of February. And it's just, you know, the question is whether, I mean, John Boehner was on Meet the Press yesterday talking about whether it was just too much too soon, but I think everybody agrees that the problems are just so enormous that it may not be too soon to get cracking.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think that argument between the liberal wing and the centrist wing will play out? What kind of package do you think we'll be seeing? Or is it too early to ask that?
Well, it's early, but the point is, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that as the, you know, in the 77 days between the election and the inauguration, I always got a sense that as the problems were mounting up, Obama's numbers were moving up as well. So as people realize there are so many things that need to be done and are fearful whether it will get done or not, it seems like the American people's hopes on him succeeding are increasing. So for right now, there seems to be a true sense from both the Republicans and the Democratic left that let's give this new president, you know, all the tools he can to you know, improve everybody's lot.
Mm-hmm. Caroline Kennedy pulling the plug. Let's talk about that. What's behind that? Everybody's trying to figure out what happened.
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, it seems like, you know, we've all remember her as, you know, those of us old enough, we always remember her as the daughter of President Kennedy and this little girl who was so consciously protected from the big bad media and the big bad world, mostly by her mother, Ben Jacqueline Kennedy, and then since her passing, just she seemed to be very, you know, she'd work very privately. But, you know, in January of 2008, she had a very public endorsement of Barack Obama. She was on the Obama's vice presidential vetting team. She gave a big speech at the Democratic convention in Denver. Obviously, she was looking for a public role. And then perhaps with her uncle Ted Kennedy's pushing, or maybe because of his pushing, she said that she would love to be considered for Hillary Clinton's Senate seat when she becomes Secretary of State. But everything went wrong from the beginning. She had this very weird listening tour upstate New York where she could, you know, her ability or inability to complete a sentence without the you knows and you mean, I mean, I am, and right. You mean, you know, sort of like the way Ken Rudin talks.
I don't think so.
No, but she was just, you know, she just didn't give a good, concise reason why she wanted to be in the Senate. She didn't explain. She missed voting a lot of times. She refused to talk about her finances. She wouldn't be accessible to the press. And with the New York media, which is so, you know, bloodthirsty to get close to politicians, it was a mistake. And I think David Paterson, the governor of New York, didn't help things by, I mean, he could have made an endorsement and an announcement right away, and she wouldn't have had to go through the whole thing. But then you had wings of the Democratic Party in New York fighting over each other. Andrew Cuomo, the state attorney general, made it clear that he wanted it, and then members of Congress wanted it, and then they were all doing lobbying, they were all campaigning, and it just seemed like a circus. It went on and on and on. And then when she pulls out, without any reason, all she did was give the governor a one-sentence statement saying, "I'm withdrawing from consideration." She never explained everything, and then the speculation was going on about all the reasons why she did pull out. Nanny problems, financial problems. I mean, the blogosphere was going crazy with just rumor and innuendo. And then David Paterson picks Kirsten Gillibrand, a congresswoman little known statewide, upstate New York, who has a 100% voting record with the NRA, which, of course, many liberals say this is unacceptable for the Democratic Party, and they were threatening a primary challenge in 2010.
Yeah. And Representative Carolyn McCarthy, tell us her story, remind us, and she will probably challenge her in 2010?
Well, she's 65 years old, and she says if nobody else takes her on, she will. Carolyn McCarthy was a Long Island housewife in 1993 when her husband was murdered by this deranged gunman on the Long Island Railroad, and she went to she was upset about the easy accessibility of guns, and Carolyn McCarthy went to her local Republican Party headquarters. She was a Republican, and said, "Look, I want to take on my local congressman. He's supporting, you know, automatic weapons and all that stuff." And they said, "No, don't bother." And so she switched to the Democratic Party, challenged her Republican to come and beat him by 17 points, and she's been the clear spokesperson against, you know, guns and the availability of guns in Congress. So when you have a Democratic member of Congress appointed to the Senate who has 100% NRA rating, that was just too much for Carolyn McCarthy. And she said, "Look, if nobody else is going to take her on, I will."
Yeah. And Governor Blagojevich all over the national press today. Why is he putting himself in that position?
Well, I'm not convinced he is from this planet, but
right.
it just seems like he has lost a sense of reality here. I mean, first of all, he's probably right saying he doesn't stand a chance in fighting his impeachment trial, which begins today in the Illinois State Senate. And all you need is 3/4 of a vote to convict him. He's already been impeached by the Illinois House, and if he's convicted, he'll be removed from office. Now, the vote in the House, only one member, I think it was like 114-1, to vote for impeachment. I expect that the vote in the Senate could be very close. And he's just not going to, he says, "Look, I can't call witnesses. I would love to call Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., and I'd love to call Rahm Emanuel, the president's new chief of staff, and Valerie Jarrett, and all those people, saying, 'Look, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't offer to sell this,' and they'll testify under oath." But of course, he's been denied the opportunity to call his own witnesses, and he says that it's stacked against him. But his, you know, his public campaign, he's going on all the networks. He's in New York today on the Today Show. He's comparing himself to Gandhi and Martin Luther King, and it's just bizarre. But
it is.
Everything has been bizarre about him from the get-go.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political every Monday at 9. Ken Rudin is our guest, political editor for National Public Radio, and we'll be with you in a moment. 800-486-8655. Take one of the lines before they get all crowded. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Nikki Giovanni will join us. She has a new book, Bicycles, and we'll look forward to speaking with her and have her read some of her poems as well. All right, two phone calls for Ken Rudin. Marty from Douglas County, our first caller. Hey, Marty.
Hey, good morning. I'm completely baffled by something, and Ken, I'm hoping you can help me unravel this. Why isn't anybody who knows anything spending any time talking about the Senate race in Minnesota? It's a really interesting situation. For instance, on Friday, I believe it was, the 3-judge panel looking at the requests from the candidates denied Norm Coleman his request to count 12,000 additional absentee ballots. And then Coleman wrote a letter to Al Franken over the weekend asking Franken to support this request to look at these absentee ballots. Franken was out in Washington last week talking to Harry Reid. Coleman has actually taken a new job or at least signed up for a new job, and nobody's spending squat time talking about it, and yet we can't talk enough about Caroline Kennedy.
Well, I think the problem is that this has been going on since November 4th, and not much has changed, but I think, Marty, you describe exactly what's going on. Al Franken, the Democratic challenger, has a 225-vote lead, and he's had that lead since the state underwent a 2.9 million-vote hand recount. Now, Norm Coleman is saying that there are about 13,000 absentee ballots that have been thrown out, rejected, and they shouldn't have been. And the question is whether the court will allow this to go on. I suspect that he has to go through every avenue he can to hold on to it. We saw, you know, Al Gore did it in 2000. Members of Congress have done it, you know, in congressional races. Franken has asked the governor, a Republican, and the Secretary of State, a Democrat, to certify him, and they say, no, it's still too premature because the thing is still in the courts. But it may be a while, and it'll probably go on for at least a month, maybe even March, before they name a winner. But I just don't see that, because even if they recount those rejected absentee ballots, Franken is going to get a lot of those votes, too. So ultimately, I think that, look, Coleman has to do what he's doing. He has to show, you know, has to wave the flag. But ultimately, I think that Franken gets sworn in. But, of course, it'll be March. And who knows what committee assignments will still be left in March.
Uh-huh. Well, I still don't understand why that isn't any more interesting than talking about Blagojevich.
Oh, it's extremely interesting, and we've been talking about it for the longest time. I mean, once upon a time, I mean, at election night, Coleman had the lead, then he had a four-vote lead and was going back and forth. The only thing about Blagojevich is just that he's just so, you know, nuts that it's just, you know, it's just a great story for tabloids. And, of course, Caroline Kennedy being the big name, but we've been talking about Franken versus Coleman for, the, you know, the 80 days or so, or the 85 days since Election Day. It's just that it's going on and on and on, and people seem to lose interest, but it's out there, and, of course, the three-judge panel begins hearing Coleman's challenge today. So I think you're going to hear a renewed interest and a renewed focus on that race. But, again, ultimately, I still think that that Franken wins.
Thanks, Marty, for your call. John from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. One of the more refreshing points of Barack Obama is his call for transparency. And I seem to remember earlier in the Bush administration, one of the presidential executive orders that President Bush issued was to prevent the release of the presidential records from his father's presidency, George H.W. Bush, during the Iran-Contra scandal era. And I'm curious, can Barack Obama or will Barack Obama issue a presidential executive order to release those presidential records? Because for some reason, President Bush obviously didn't want those records to be released, and I'm curious as to, number one, why he didn't want them to be released, and number two, can President Barack Obama issue a presidential executive order to have those records released?
Well, you know something, this is a very interesting question, and when George W. Bush said he did not want Bill Clinton's personal, those records to be released before a certain number of years have gone by, I thought, that how interesting that he's going along with not wanting Bill Clinton's records, and didn't even occur to me that maybe one of the reasons he said this is because he didn't want his father's records released at all. I have not heard any quote or any comment by Obama about this, and I suspect that Obama's bid for transparency will involve his own administration and not previous ones. But I don't think Obama is going to dig into that because, of course, if they go after George H.W. Bush, then they'll go after William J. Clinton. So I don't know if Obama wants to play that. But
that's part of transparency. We want to see transparency.
Well, we absolutely do, and I think there's some kind of a number of years that need to go by. But you know, John, you make a very good point. I always, whenever Bush said that he agreed that the Clinton stuff shouldn't be released, and I always wondered why he felt had that position, and perhaps the reason is because he didn't want his father's stuff released as well.
Well, it was a 10-year law. They said that after 10 years after a presidency, that's when the records are to be released, and that was after Watergate. And his father's 10-year anniversary was coming up, so Bill Clinton still wouldn't have been released. It would have been his father's that had exceeded the 10-year rule.
Right, that's very interesting. It'd be interesting to see if it comes up. I suspect that Obama's not the one who's going to bring it up, but if somebody else does bring it up, I'd love to see what the new president talks about. That's a very good point. I hadn't thought about that.
Thank you, John, for your call. Earl is next from Medford. Hi, Earl.
Good morning, Kathleen and Ken.
Good morning.
I was watching a show about Franklin Roosevelt on public TV, and he started the New Deal, it seemed, by saying, we're going to try this, and then if that doesn't work, then we'll try that. A very pragmatic approach, but also one that even people in northern Wisconsin know well because of roads and parks and refuges and things like that. So is Obama going to follow the Roosevelt model fairly closely?
Well, the thing with the Roosevelt model, if you remember, is that, you know, as bad as the Depression was in 1933 when he took office, it didn't get better for 8 years. As a matter of fact, I don't think it improved until World War II, which is a hell of a way to get rid of a depression. But I wonder if people have the patience and tolerance that they had back in the 30s, because it, not only was the things got worse, in 1936, Roosevelt only lost two states, and you could make the argument that in 1936, the situation was worse than it was in 1932, but it seems like people believed in what Roosevelt was standing for, and they were willing to give him a chance. In this world of 24/7 cable networks and, you know, needing solutions immediately, or if not yesterday, I wonder if people will have the patience. And I think that's why Obama's speech has always been, this is going to be long, this is not going to be quick, there's going to be a lot of sacrifice involved. And one of the problems I think that George W. Bush had from the beginning is that he never spoke of sacrifice. As dire as the situation was, he never talked about what people should give up. I think Obama, at least from the inauguration on, he's made it clear that, you know, the way we've been living is just not the way it's going to be in the future. But the question is whether the American people will give him a shot. I think the 2010 mid-year elections will be a big indication to see if the American people have that patience.
And what does he want us to give up? Has he been clear about that, do you think, Ken?
Well, I think we have been giving up things. First of all, we're not spending as much, and we're certainly not spending as much, and we're saving more than we had, and that's fine. But, of course, when you don't spend, then businesses suffer and businesses close. So I just suspect that, you know, it's almost kind of interesting that in the midst of that thing, he's insisting on sticking with his middle-class tax cut. Now, you know, it's interesting when George W. Bush talked about tax cuts, it was, you know, bad. You know, the Democrats said it was a bad thing, and perhaps maybe the fact that there will be an increase in taxes on the wealthy, that's tolerable. But it just seems like with so many things that need to be done, with so many sacrifices that need to be made, I'm not sure if tax cuts is the way to go. But again, you know, the Obama administration seems to be determined to continue that.
Yeah. One more phone call for you. Let's go to Ann from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the Timothy Geithner nomination. Congress is being flooded with phone calls opposing it. First, he was one of the main architect of the $700 billion bailout with no strings attached. I'm sure he's a good buddy of Henry Paulson and the Bush people. He's a financial guy who was in the IMF and, while he was there, refused to pay, or was basically a Scott Law, mm-hmm. about paying about $34,000 in Social Security and Medicare taxes. And it seems to me that if he is confirmed, he is going to be looked at as a model by all Americans. The people who are struggling, most of us aren't millionaires, are going to say, the head of the Treasury, which can take money out of our pockets at will, is contemptuous of the tax system for himself, who is so rich. And I think he's just a really lousy example.
It's an amazing example, because if you listen to the testimony, he kept saying over and over again, well, it was a mistake, well, I forgot, well, I should have known better. Well, for God's sakes, I mean, this guy is not only running the Treasury Department, he's running the IRS. But ultimately, I think the word in Washington is either that the situation is so terrible that we just need his economic team in place, but for somebody like this who made such a terrible mistake, it's like I'm trying to think of a good example, it's just remarkable that somebody who is in charge of such an important department in the government to have made these kind of mistakes, it's just remarkable. And if you look at polls, I think are pretty even. A lot of people feel that this is a big mistake, but it seems like everybody's willing to go along with it. And so the vote is expected at 6 o'clock today Eastern Time, and the full Senate, with maybe only a handful of dissenters, is going to confirm him.
Hmm. Thanks, Ann, very much for the call. Ken, always a pleasure to talk with you, and Happy New Year.
James, too, but one thing you also know that Russ Feingold is offering an amendment today to take the appointments of new senators out of the hands of governors and make a special election. So I think there's a combination of what Blagojevich did, what David Paterson did, Feingold is hoping that that would go away.
Mm. Is that a good idea, do you think?
I think so. I mean, this was a very ugly situation this year with all these appointments, and perhaps maybe do what they do with the House, you know, have special elections and let the people decide.
Right. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Joining us the next half hour of All Things Political, Mark Silva, and we thank you for your call. And Mark is with the Chicago Tribune, where he's White House correspondent. He's been there for about 9 years, about 6 years, has covered the conclusion of the 2004 presidential campaign, where he started covering that in Florida. He right now leads the newspaper's White House coverage and has traveled nationally and internationally with President Bush through Europe, Asia, Australia, and Africa. Also traveled with Vice President Dick Cheney and with the First Lady. Covers national politics, Florida politics for 25 years, as well as the presidential elections of 2000 and 2004. He was political editor for the Orlando Sentinel for a number of years, covering state and national campaigns, reported for the Miami Herald for 21 years, and was senior political writer for the Herald, covering the presidential election that ended with the battle, of course, that we remember so well over the disputed Florida ballots in his hometown at that time, Tallahassee. He is joining us now, and we'll be welcoming more phone calls as we continue All Things Political. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. Or you could send an email. I think I forgot to tell you that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Mark, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. How are you?
Well, I'm all right. How are you?
Great.
Good. Whole new thing for you, huh, sir? Whole new thing.
It's a different direction, that's for sure.
Yeah. Do you notice it right away in little things or not?
Well, not so little things. In big things. The way the Obama White House is communicating is quite different. It's they're taking advantage of the internet, YouTube, and the like to sort of get past the media, and they're trying to set their own agenda very quickly.
Mm-hmm. You, in your article last Tuesday on Inauguration Day, talked about the president asking Americans to embrace a new era of responsibility. Do you think that's defined for us? What does that mean?
Well, I suspect it means people taking more responsibility for the environment around them, for one thing, being more cognizant of their impact on, everything from global warming to the neighborhood. I think a lot of what Obama has talked about and is trying to talk about is the sense of neighborhood and community that that people should have. And in the global sense, it's taking care of the earth, I suppose.
And what would you say about his first week in office? Is he off and running? Is he tackling big issues? And also take on whether or not he's going to be given a honeymoon period?
Well, there's a bit of a honeymoon period, which has to do with the goodwill with which he entered office. He entered with personal approval ratings, a high favorable rating of himself. And, 3 days into office, the first take that the Gallup poll made of presidential approval, job approval, was 68% on Saturday. That was after three full days in office. So, that's a plane at which Dwight Eisenhower started. It's not quite the 72% that John Kennedy had at the beginning, but it's among the highest of any approval ratings for a starting president in the last close to 60 years. So there's that goodwill measure, which has a lot to do with the so-called honeymoon. He also very quickly asserted himself on a number of fronts with executive orders ranging from everything from the interrogation techniques used for terrorism suspects, requiring that the U.S. Army field manual be used by all agencies, prohibiting torture, basically, and ranging to public records in government. His among his first phone calls in office were to the leaders of the Middle Eastern nations, Israeli leaders, Palestinian leaders, Egyptian, Jordanian, to try to stake some ground in the Middle East. He's going to have an envoy, George Mitchell. So he's trying to cover international and domestic fronts, and he's covered a lot of them in the first few days.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing all that's on the plate, isn't it?
Well, he inherited one royal mess, and you know, that stretches from the economic crisis at home, which you know, had really started to climax as he was taking office, and it includes the, you know, the foreign situation, which is a legacy of our war in Iraq and our handling of terrorism suspects. So there's a lot to deal with on every front.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about his almost $1 trillion stimulus package. What's the sense you're getting from Republicans, from Democrats as well, as to what reasonably can be agreed on here? And also, we'll pair that with what the American people are looking for.
Well, on the congressional front, I think it's really a question of how many people buy into it, because it would seem that the Democratic leadership is pretty much assured of passing a program very much like the one Obama wants, without much help from Republicans. So, you know, it's aimed at putting shovels in the ground quickly, so to speak. In other words, work that can translate into new jobs quickly. And a lot of it is public works oriented, sort of everything from, you know, electrical transmission lines being laid for solar power and wind energy and this sort of thing, to weatherizing homes and federal buildings, and then roads, you know, the nuts and bolts of road building and bridge building, which is quick public works. And there's a lot of that orientation. And the Republicans are more interested in getting more tax relief into it rather than the government dishing out money, allowing people to hold on to their own money. And that's the big Republican push. But again, the extent to which the Obama White House can pass a package that is sort of light on tax reform and heavy on public works, it really just depends on how willing they are to, you know, put it together with a close vote as opposed to an overwhelming vote.
Right.
As far as the public's concerned, you know, I think what people would like to see is some immediate turnaround, some immediate results. I think there's huge public dismay over the initial first economic stimulus package that, you know, bailed out the banks and the financial institutions with no obvious return. So there's that has become instantly very unpopular. So I think the public is looking for something that they can get their arms around.
Yeah. Can you put a massive public works program together fairly quickly? It seems to me as though that would be a complicated procedure.
Well, in some cases, yes, because, you know, a lot of states have, you know, 5-year work plans. I mean, they have projects that are on the shelf ready to go. Schools, you know, public schools have sort of cookie cutter plans for building new buildings. You know, they'll build a number of schools on the same model. And so it's not like you got to go out and, you know, go to the drawing board and design a school from scratch. And it's not like you have to go out and design a road project from scratch. There's a lot of public works on the shelf, just by virtue of the way government plans things, that, you know, once some money is authorized, yeah, you could start letting contracts. This question of, you know, building 3,000 miles of electronic or electrical transmission lines for, you know, solar energy and wind power, I mean, that's a little more pie in the sky. I don't think anybody has sat down to, you know, figure out, you know, how that grid is going to be starting to be built tomorrow. So there's a range of things that can go immediately versus some things that will take some more time.
Mark Silva, our guest for All Things Political this half hour, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. He's White House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. Our number is 800-486-8655. Line or two open right now if you'd like to take it, or send an email, and that's talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, Nikki Giovanni will be with us. She has a new book of poetry, and it is titled Bicycles, Love Poems. Nikki Giovanni after the news from NPR at 10. All right, let's go to phone calls now for Mark. 800-486-8655. Dan from Barrington Hills, Illinois is our first caller this half hour. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Yes, hello.
Yes, go ahead, Dan.
Okay, yeah. Really two things, but first, Geithner is, he's knowledgeable in the financial area, that's very clear. And I'm sure he understood when the IRS examined his returns in 2006, he paid for 2003 and 2004 because the statute of limitations was still over. The IRS would never pass up 1 and 2 because it was the same issue. They would immediately pick those returns up and make that examination. He didn't pay because the statute of limitations was expired when they reached him in 2006. I don't see that mentioned in any news articles that I read, and I don't hear anybody mentioning it at all. And Congress never asked him about that. And there are an awful lot of people that understand the statute of limitations. It's 3 years after you file. April 15th, whichever is later.
We had a caller critical. We had Ken and Rudin on the first half hour, and a caller was critical of the nomination of Geithner and had deep concerns about his not paying the taxes and being in charge of the IRS as well. So that's where that comes from, Mark.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's a lot of questions about a guy who only pays what he has to pay, which doesn't put him in a very different category from a lot of Americans when it comes to filing taxes. I mean, everybody tries to follow the rules, but if the IRS comes and tells you that you owe back taxes for a couple of years, you pay. I'm not sure you necessarily pony up and say, well, I think I'll also pay for the 2 years previously, even though they didn't ask for it. So, yes, it's a question. Yes, is he going to run the IRS? Uh-huh. But I think... fairly, there's a broader question about the man's breadth of knowledge about the economy and the Treasury and Wall Street and the bigger picture of the economic recovery. And yeah, sure, it's a stumbling block. The Obama people knew about it in the vetting, and their mistake probably was not making people aware of it when they learned about it. It had to sort of come out later. So there's a little bit of sloppiness to go around.
He said he didn't pay because it was carelessness. He should have done it. That's really not true. The reason he didn't pay is just what you said. I don't know it. Why should I pay it? I mean, you're right. Who would write a check for $34,000 if you don't have to write a check, especially to the IRS? But no one said that. Everyone, it was carelessness, and they all said, oh, okay, it was carelessness. Listen, anybody can make a mistake. In my, it was the facts to me dictate it was no mistake. It was a knowing act.
Well, the fact that he subsequently did pay those back taxes would sort of answer the question about whether it needed to be paid or not. So, by his own actions, has acquiesced to the question.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan, very much for your call. Let's go to Tom from River Falls. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
Hey, you guys were just talking about public works and its effectiveness, and earlier there was a caller asking your previous guest, Ken Rudin, whether Obama would follow the FDR model with public works, and Ken Rudin surprisingly said, well, I don't know. I mean, it didn't work until World War II, and the people were really patient. I don't know if they had the patience, all the way up for 8-9 years, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, how did he get that so wrong? I mean, unemployment was 25% in 1933, and before World War II in 1941, it dropped all the way down to 14%. Of course, it's still bad, but it dropped from 25 to 14, and the people saw that. And then, of course, you had FDIC, which saved the banks, and then you had Social Security in 1935, and then the Fair Labor Act, all before the World War II, supposedly, which pulled us out. So I just wanted to make that point that the people weren't patient. They saw this was working from 33 to 41 before World War II, and I was just surprised that Ken Rudin completely got that wrong.
Okay. Do you see parallels between now and the time of the Great Depression that I know Obama's been reading about the first 100 days of FDR and Lincoln, but are there parallels or was the situation much more dire back
then?
Well,
the situation was far more dire, and it was far more severe, and the difference too is that today the government provides a safety net, which is largely a result of the Depression, which didn't exist at the time. So people's bank accounts disappeared. That's not happening. And in fact, the first thing the government did was to double the insurance under the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation as the crisis arose. So there is a federal protection insurance for personal holdings, at least in banks, not on the stock market, clearly, but. Yeah, there is that safety net, which I think has made this somewhat different. And also, the government took immediate action, although people don't much appreciate the effect of the bailout. Clearly the infusion of billions of dollars into failing institutions, staunched what was probably a much more calamitous potential collapse. So, the existing government protections that were here as a result of the Depression, the government action that came into play. I mean, I think these are two of the things that have made this quite a different scenario.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Tom. Steve from Mount Horeb is next. Hi, Steve.
Oh, hi. Good morning, Kathleen and Mark. Yes, I have a couple questions, and one is
regarding our economic concerns, and do you think that President Obama will address our military-industrial complex concerns regarding our economy, that we're in two wars and we still have a dismal economy? That's my first question. And then my second one is that I had one grandfather who worked in the CCC camps, and I think there's a lot of aspects to our public infrastructure, and I would like to see it more local with, like, solar and wind. And I was wondering, what do you think about that, the local concern?
Well, on the energy front, you know, as they talk about the so-called smart power grid, the discussion really does center around the ability of homes to essentially sell back power to the grid. I mean, if you have a solar panel that is generating more power than your home needs at the moment, you can reverse it. You know, the technology exists to reverse the energy out to essentially, you know, sell it to the grid, what you're producing. So, I mean, there's that aspect of this whole energy question of people becoming more, you know, everything becoming much more localized. You know, on the other hand, they're talking about the government weatherizing a couple of million homes or some number of homes. So that's something that people, it remains to be seen how that'll be sorted out. I'm not sure who's on the list or how you get on the list. But in the broader question of the military-industrial complex, you know, this is one of the most rooted industries in town. It took years to redesign the presidential helicopter that Obama will be flying at some point in the next few years, a huge boondoggle. I mean, it reaches every aspect of the military. And, you know, while troops are withdrawn from Iraq, the military is building up in Afghanistan. And Obama is clearly committed to initially a doubling of U.S. force in Afghanistan. So that, you know, whole industry is not going away. The military situation, we're spending roughly on the military what we spend on our foreign debt, our national debt, the accumulated national debt. So, you know, this is it's a big expense.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I think it's still cause for concern. And thanks. And as far as the grid, what I thought I heard you say is that we need to have like a big grid system. Well, what I'm trying to say is that I think there's more opportunity locally, and like you said, through homes and weatherization and homes with systems that do net meter, put home electricity onto our local grid. And,
right.
And I see a better system with a more regional aspect to our grid. Like I don't think we need a grid going from New York to Los Angeles. I don't think that'll help. I think we need to keep it local, and that's where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well.
All right.
Well,
thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk about the loyal opposition for a moment, and where the Republicans are going in terms of bipartisanship, in terms of cooperation, and when they're saying, "Wait a second, we don't like this direction." And I'm also interested in extending that to the press just a little bit. I was interested in Barack Obama's comments when he gathered some Republican leadership last week. You can't listen to Rush Limbaugh and get things done. Which seemed like a fairly direct kind of comment. And then you've got Boehner talking about how can you spend hundreds of millions of dollars on contraceptives, et cetera. What is the role of the opposition here? Is there a willingness to help succeed here because the problems are so vast, or are we going to see opposition and pretty fierce opposition right off the bat, Mark?
Well, surely there's an urgency on the part of Republican leaders to alleviate the trouble, and they don't want to be seen as obstructionist. They don't want to be seen as standing in the way between you know, needed relief and the American public. At the same time, they've got principles about, you know, how they believe economic stimulus really takes place, and it's through tax cuts. And you know, they're also putting together their, you know, basic game plan for the midterm elections as well. I mean, this is less than 2 years away now, and so the party's got to stand for something. something. It's got to stand for an approach to the economy. And so, you know, actually, you can almost have your cake and eat it, too, on this one, because you can say that you're looking out for the public's interest with your tax cut policy and trying to get as much of that into the economic stimulus plan as you can, while at the same time not going too far. And, you know, John McCain's in an interesting position. He was interviewed asking if he would support the Obama plan, and ultimately he said no, he wouldn't support it. Well, we'll see how long that lasts, because if you are viewed ultimately as standing in the way of something the public needs, that's not going to be good for your party, probably.
Mm-hmm. So that throwing a special dinner, you need a couple dinners, huh?
Well, I suppose. They really do have a bit of a monopoly here in town with Congress and the White House at the moment. So the difficulty for the Republican Party is going to be reasserting its stake, mm-hmm. and getting ready for the midterms and rallying around a platform that has some public appeal to it.
Right. You know, you say that, and I go, oh, no, another election starting 2 years before the election, getting ready for the midterms. Haven't we been through it already?
No, we get about a week off between elections. That's about all we get.
It's a bit much, isn't it? Let's go to Mike from Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Before I make my comment on the Feingold-McCain pork bill legislation, I just wanted to refer to the first caller's question about Geithner. Unfortunately for Geithner, what he did was he perjured himself during the confirmation process when Senator Kyle pinned him down on the 01 to 03 taxes. He claimed he wasn't aware of those taxes until the confirmation process, which I don't think anyone believes. So that's his biggest trouble to me, is that he actually perjured himself. But my primary comment, Senator Feingold and McCain are trying to rifle through an anti-pork piece of legislation. And it's almost comical as you consider it, because most of the bailout is one giant pork barrel project. There's $600 million for GSA cars, which don't exist yet, these alternative fuel cars, $50 million to the National Endowment for the Arts. Not that I don't support that, but that's purely pork by anyone's definition. How does the guest think that this anti-pork legislation is going to marry up with the overall bailout program?
Well, you know, I think there's at least one distinction, and it may sound rhetorical, but it's the distinction between pork barrel and earmarks. The earmarks that are so famous are projects that have been essentially inserted at the behest of a lobbyist or a senator without any kind of real scrutiny. The Bridge to Nowhere is the most famous. And, you know, versus you could really describe almost any kind of federal spending that benefits a local project or supports a local project as quote pork barrel. I mean, it's government money building something that's going to be popular back home. So, you know, it's a question of process in some ways. Are projects being advanced that have a rationale to them, that have been through some sort of real public vetting process through, you know, departments of transportation that have, you know, put together these work plans and the like, or is it just strictly sort of an out of the hip pocket kind of, hey, I got a fun project here for my, you know, my museum director's been looking for this for a long time, and now we got a way to sneak it through. So, yeah, it's all in the it's in the eye of the beholder to some extent. But I think the larger question is the process that these things go through. Is there a rationale and a planned out, you know, equitable process through which projects are advanced and finally funded, which is the distinction between a pure earmark and public works.
And thanks very much for the call. You're covering all of this for the Chicago Tribune. There have been some interesting things said about the fact that this president is from a very large urban area, from Chicago, and it will make a difference. And we've already seen it in terms of who he's brought with him to the White House. What about making a difference in terms of how he treats the major urban centers in this country?
Well, you know, he does have the urban orientation, the first, you know, president in a while. So I think that remains to be seen. I think we'll see it in, for instance, in housing, in HUD, in the way the government approaches the federal housing question, which has been really one of the boondoggles of the federal government for decades. You know, you talk about earmarks. I mean, the political process of tax breaks for low-income housing developers has been just rife with cronyism and lobbyists. And so, you know, if the federal government could actually get its act together in urban housing, in jobs, inner-city jobs, then we'll start to see some, you know, some indication of how Obama's urban orientation plays out. But, again, that's going to take some time to read.
And the second week, in terms of the first week, what action are you following this week, Mark?
Well, more talk about the economy. The president was speaking about it this morning. I think you're going to see a stepped-up attempt to get the plan through Congress. He wants to have it approved before President's Day, which I think is February 16th. And so, you know, you'll see a concerted effort to ramp up the profile of the economic program. We're hearing some things on the environmental front, like the EPA allowing states such as California to have tougher emission standards for their automobiles than the federal government has, which is something the auto industry has fought for years. And so, you know, we'll see various aspects of the agenda that we really haven't heard about before, ranging from the EPA to, you know, who knows, immigration or what, but whatever. Right. But I think the economic focus is going to become intensified in the next couple of weeks to try to get this plan through.
Right. Thanks, Mark, so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Mark Silva, the White House correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. We also want to thank Ken Rudin. And Ken is the political editor for National Public Radio, where he directs campaign coverage for the network. Thanks to both of them and to Rhonda Fanning and Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks, everybody, for all your calls. News coming up, we'll return here on the Ideas Network.